You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. More than three decades ago, construction workers unearthed something unusual while building new homes in Granite Bay. They discovered a fossilized plant buried for literally eons. The ancient plant was collected by researchers at Sierra College and preserved in its Natural History Museum in Rockland. And there it sat really for decades, and only recently has its scientific significance been realized. A curious professor from the University of Kansas took a closer look at this fossil, and after careful examination, released a study suggesting that this discovery has helped close a critical gap in the fossil record. It reveals the ancestors of an incredibly diverse family of flowering plants that we all enjoy today that includes close relatives of coffee and potatoes, which evolved during the last days of the dinosaurs. I sat down with Richard Hilton, professor of earth sciences at Sierra College, and Brian Atkinson, assistant professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Kansas, about the fascinating story of this fossil, tens of millions of years in the making. So I want to get a little 101 on each of you. Why did each of you pursue careers in paleobotany and earth sciences? Professor Hilton, I'll start with you.
Well, I started out to be a biologist, but ended up changing in my junior year to geology. And then it's led me ultimately to paleontology, the study of life on Earth in the past. Mm.
And how about you, Professor Atkinson?
Great question. So I started out in undergraduate college as a plant biology major. And paleobotany was not on my radar until much later in my college career. And I saw a talk given by a paleobotanist about his name is Gar Rothwell, he's still around. And he gave a talk about how fossil plants can inform understanding of how plants evolved in time. And it made so much sense to me. I asked if I can do a research project with them, and it was a wrap after that. So.
And the rest is, pun intended, history, right? Taking a look back and now leading to this moment now. So, Professor Hilton, you're part of a discovery that was really like tens of millions of years in the making. So let's take that baby step back in time to the 1990s. What were the sequence of events that led to this fossil discovery and how you ultimately became involved?
Well, I was teaching at Sierra College at the time and with the Sierra College Natural History Museum. And I got a phone call from a local fireman by the name of Pat Antuzzi. And he said he'd found what he thought was a dinosaur bone. And I'm going, yeah, right. No dinosaurs around here. Anyway, I went to see him, and he pulled out this fossil. And it was a bone. And it was from the Chico Formation, which puts it in the Mesozoic, the time of dinosaurs. And he said, I think it's a dinosaur. And I said to him, I think you're right, but I can't prove it. So I contacted Berkeley, a guy named Greg Erickson. He did some science on it, and he agreed that it was a dinosaur. And not only a dinosaur, but a young dinosaur. So we started looking, and they were doing houses at the time and digging deep ditches for the piping and so forth, the storm drains. And coming out of these ditches was all kinds of fossils from the ocean. It was an ocean setting, but we were also getting fossils from the land, both plants and animals.
I mean, you're talking that this was, at that time, an ocean setting. So kind of take us back to that time when this fossil was alive. What would we see if we took a walk around this landscape, which is now a largely suburb area in the foothills, like 70, 80 million years ago?
70, 80 million years ago, the original Sierra Nevada was much bigger than the one we have today and extended far to the east and was capped by volcanoes. What was happening in the Mesozoic time of the dinosaurs is Pangaea was breaking up, the supercontinent. And this is about plate tectonics, the fact that the crust of the Earth moves around in plates. And the Americas were moving away from Europe and Africa and opening Atlantic Ocean. And that was closing the Pacific Ocean. By 82 million years ago, that original mountain range had eroded away. You know, miles of rock had eroded away and was deposited offshore in the valley here. And the ocean probably went as far east as maybe Colfax.
Wow.
At the time.
And that's like a, you know, on a good day, like a 2 hour, little over 2 hour drive from what is the ocean now, like in the Bay Area. That's incredible.
Oh, easily 2 hours. So there was no coast range. There was just, you know, a continental shelf where most of these fossils are being deposited.
Wow. Well, okay. So now, Professor Atkinson, that brings me to you because you're based in Kansas. When did you come into the picture to really understand the significance of this fossil, decades later?
Great question, Vicky. So this all kind of goes back. Much of my PhD work when I was a student in grad school involved this, collecting and describing Cretaceous plants, specifically flowering ones, from Vancouver Island in British Columbia, Canada. And by Cretaceous, I mean anywhere between 145 to 66 million years ago. So this is like the last hurrah of the dinosaurs. And as I was collecting all these fossils, plant fossils, I began to like understand like the western coast of North America might be this really special place for plant diversity during this time period. And so as I started my job here in Kansas, the University of Kansas, I wanted to learn more by looking at different, basically, localities or fossil deposits along the West Coast. And this region is actually surprisingly under-sampled or under-collected for this interval of time, for plants, that is. So I figured the more that we collect here, the more we can learn about plant diversity and evolution during the Cretaceous. So I've been kind of, I was working with some people at the Natural History Museum in LA County and asking them if they know any potential localities elsewhere in California. Somebody had told me to get in touch with a professor at Chico State, Russell Shapiro, who told me then to get in contact with Richard Hilton, who had collected all these fossil plants from Granite Bay. And so I did, and Richard got me into contact with folks at Sierra College Museum of Natural History. And from there, they showed me some of the collections that Richard and Patrick had made in the 1990s. And, you know, I was expecting to see some cool stuff. And then when they pulled some drawers out, I was blown away. It was some like the best Cretaceous plant material that I've ever seen. It's like the fruits and seeds that were in there are three-dimensionally preserved, sometimes down to the cellular level. And it's like they were just dropped like yesterday. And so it's like exceptional preservation. And I will forever remain grateful for Richard and Patrick for collecting that material.
We had a ball doing that.
I bet you did. Yeah.
I can imagine. I mean, Professor Hilton, were you expecting that call from another professor, let alone, you know, in another state, somewhere else in the country, about something that you preserved and partly discovered decades ago?
Yeah, I mean, when we were finding these fossils, I was bringing them to attention to various other professionals that knew that particular subject, but nothing came of it. So I was thrilled. I was really thrilled when Brian wanted to look at these things, and I'm hoping he's going to have some more publications on some of the things we've found.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally.
So, Professor Atkinson, you were very impressed by what you discovered at Sierra College, and your wheelhouse is paleobotany. I'm just curious, why is this fossil so significant, and how does it help fill in the gaps in the fossil record?
Yeah, that's a great question, Vicky. So, this particular fossil is called Paleophytocrene chicoensis, chicoensis being named after the Chico Formation from where it came from. And the genus Paleophytocrene belongs to this family called Icacinaceae, which today is typically only found in the tropics. Icacinaceae is part of this really diverse group of plants called the lamiates. And by diverse, I mean lots of species. We're talking about 40,000 species of flowering plants that include some of the crops that our livelihoods and economy depend on, like coffee, potatoes, tomatoes, those sorts of things. And that diverse group of lamiates really doesn't have a fossil record in the Cretaceous period prior to my work, at least solid evidence. And I just felt like they had to be around. And it's been taking me about 7 years to find this. And so now we have kind of like this missing piece of the puzzle. There's still a lot more work to do, but this was a major, really critical step forward. And it was quite validating, too. I was like, has to be there.
Anyways. Yeah, I can imagine. And 7 years is a long time for an individual, but in the context of this conversation, it's just like not even a blink of an eye.
Yeah.
You know, so you brought up some crops that we eat today. And so what is the connection to the vegetables and the roots and the fruits that we eat today to the fossil discovery?
Great question. So Icacinaceae, that family, is closely related to those crops relative to other groups of flowering plants that we know of. And so this close relationship is broader within this group of plants called the Lamiids. So to understand basically how the Lamiids became so diverse and like how their evolution led to things like potatoes and tomatoes, we kind of need to understand when they diversified or when this broader group diversified. And then we can start to piece together other biological, environmental events that led to the diversification of some of the plants that we're more familiar with today.
It's just crazy to think about how, I mean, we know what happened to the dinosaurs, that there are periods that can just wipe out species, but yet, you know, this plant species that was essentially fossilized, you know, we can still see it in some respect millennia, eons later. I mean, that's just crazy to think about.
Yeah, plants are pretty tough. Like, they fare pretty well when it comes to mass extinction events. And that's partly due to, like, how they live. Like, seeds are long-lasting and so forth. So, like, if you just wait a little while, they'll come back. And one other aspect I want to put about this fossil is that Paleophytocrene, it belongs to this smaller group of Icacinaceae plants called Phytocrineae, and those form woody vines in tropical forests.
So, Professor Hilton, was this a rainforest at some time?
Well, some of the fossils that we found included tree ferns. We have a trunk of a tree fern that we found, and other fern fronds. We found cycads. You may know them as sago palms, several conifers, including the Araucaria tree that grows today in the southern hemisphere. And so I took a trip to Chile to go to the Araucaria forest just to see what it would be like. There's early redwoods, there's false cypress, lots of flowering plants. So we already had a pretty good idea that this forest was lush. But now we've got this tropical vine, and I'm thinking, yeah, this probably was a rainforest. So that, he's really expanding on our knowledge there.
Yeah, that's incredible. Professor Atkinson, you had the honor of naming this fossilized plant. What goes into naming a fossil?
This is probably the part I like the least, is having to come up with a name, although I do acknowledge names are important because I'm not that creative.
I'm not even going to try to say it, so you can say
it. It's okay. So Paleophytocrene, that name has already been established since like the 1930s. The species name is usually something descriptive about that organism, whether it's the geography where it's found or like something that's noticeable about it, like if it had wings or if it had a bunch of holes or if it's big, small, that sort of thing. And sometimes organisms are named after people as well that made important contributions to the field or were meaningful to the person who's describing the species. That's kind of it in a nutshell. I would like to get a little bit more creative with my names, but I describe a lot of different species, and sometimes you just gotta go with the path of least resistance.
So the latter part has Chico in it, and that goes back to the Chico Formation that you were talking about, Professor Hilton. How large of an area are we talking about?
Chico Formation is kind of intermittent along the east side of the valley from about Stockton or a little farther south. All the way up to Red Bluff and Redding. And it's full of fossils. I mean, we find lots of invertebrates, bivalves, clams and oysters, gastropods, snails. We find sea urchins, starfish, crinoids. These are related to sea urchins that live on a stem. They're animals. But lots of vertebrates as well. There's been several types of shark and other fish. We have a mosasaur called Cladastes, which we found right here in Granite Bay. This is a seagoing varanid lizard, so related to the Komodo dragon. Three types of marine turtles, and the one dinosaur. In other areas of the Chico Formation, there have been pterosaur remains found and birds and one mammal. The mammals were evolving in the Mesozoic along with these plants.
You know, how has this fossil, this recent one, helped shape what you teach in the classroom, Professor Hilton? It's pretty cool. You know, it got a lot of interest from the surrounding community.
Well, I mainly do field classes now. But field classes in the past, we used to go to Montana and Wyoming and Arizona. We would have dinosaur digs. So it's really neat in a community college to get students out in the field. And it changes their lives and their outlook of the history, the deep history of our planet.
Yeah, and it could be right under our feet. We don't even have to travel that far, right? Professor Atkinson, I imagine this is just the beginning for you. I mean, you mentioned that this part of the West is largely undiscovered. Where is this going to take your research?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I had planned to work on the West Coast, especially California, for a long time. And yeah, it's only just beginning, and there's I'm totally stoked by what I've seen so far and what I'll be able to work on in the near term and long term.
Yeah, and that stokeness is just like created ripple effects for students of Professor Hilton, but also the general public, because the public can see this fossil, right, at the Sierra College Natural History Museum in Rockland?
I'm not sure that one's on display. It's probably in a drawer, but the museum does have a myriad of fossils to look at. It's kind of unknown. People don't really realize it's there, but you can go in there 6 days a week from 8 in the morning till 10 at night, and it's a marvelous museum.
What goes into preserving a fossil? I mean, you took part in this in the 90s for the fossil we're talking about today.
Well, it depends on the fossils. You know, some you just collect and keep them dry and, you know, glue things back together. But other fossils, you know, when we go out and collect, we've collected two Triceratops skulls, and, you know, they don't come out of the rock just whole. I mean, I had a Triceratops skull on my kitchen counter for 2 years.
That's the first time I've ever heard that.
Assembling all the pieces together to finally get it good enough for display purposes. You know, I've been working on some fossils down here at Ione, and we just did a jaw, for example, of a four-tusked elephant, a gomphothere. And you have to pedestal all around the fossil, dig down, and then it's burlap and plaster on the top. And then you dig under it, and then eventually you dig under it far enough that you can break it off. And you bring the whole fossil with the rock. And then once you get it in the lab, it's the slow, steady, you know, exhuming of this fossil and, you know, impregnating it with chemicals that will preserve it sometimes. But that's a lot of work. So some of them you just bring to the museum, they're already ready to go. Some of them you spend years and everything in between.
A lot of work, but I also think I was just going to say, it still seems like a lot of fun for you.
Yeah, we have these giant jigsaw three-dimensional puzzles, you know, that we put together. It's a whole lot of fun.
I think that may be the first and only time I'll have someone tell me that they had a Triceratops skull on their in their home on their table. Brian, I want to end with you. I mean, dinosaur bone skeletons, as we're talking about, I mean, they're always a big hit when you go to natural history museums. But why do you believe plant fossils are fascinating, and how do they help us better understand prehistoric life on Earth?
I'll begin with that dinosaurs didn't exist in a vacuum. They obviously were major components of environments, but if you look outside your window for most places in the world, or a lot of places in the world, you'll see that, depending on time of year, I guess, that's covered in green. And in fact, like, our lives depend on plants. There's no question about it. And so basically how plants evolved in time, how they diversified, how they changed morphologically, or how their features change, is really important in tying together like how plants co-evolved with their environment, with other animals and so forth. So that is kind of one reason why I do what I do, is to better understand like how these organisms came to be. Specifically, these organisms, our livelihoods depend on and our food depends on, our culture depends on. I think that's a major part of like knowing where we belong on this planet.
Professor Hilton, how about you?
Yeah, well, you're looking at a paleo environment here. You're looking at the diversity of all the life. And what's nice about the Granite Bay fossils is we had fossils from the land. So looking at all the plants and looking at some of the animals, you get an idea of the diversity that's going on. You can start to form a picture. I kind of think of it as looking through a keyhole to the past. You've only got the keyhole, and you just hope that that keyhole gets a little larger and you discover more fossils to make it even more diverse and interesting. But you're looking at the past. It's incredible.
Professors Hilton and Atkinson, thank you for the time and the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us on.
That is Richard Hilton, professor of earth sciences at Sierra College, and Brian Atkinson, assistant professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Kansas, who shared the fascinating story of a Granite Bay fossil and how it helped close a significant gap in the fossil record. Still ahead, Habitat for Humanity is creating homeownership opportunities for lower-income households in both Sacramento and Yolo counties. The nonprofit joins us about its latest round of applications, which opens up today. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.